Okay, thank you very much for the invitation to participate in this great program and to give this talk here. It's nice to be back to Santa Barbara after maybe more than 10 years. I don't quite remember, but. Okay, so I'll be talking about the Harrison theories. The title is slightly different from the one that was announced because I decided that I should focus first on some very general aspects in the beginning and then coming to very few recent developments, because there is plenty of interesting things people are working on these days. So my plan is basically this talk will consist of three parts. In the beginning, I will discuss in a very general terms the properties of these hierarchy theories, which are sometimes very unusual. Then I will explain in some detail a fundamental issue that underlies these theories, which namely, what is the higher-spin algebra, namely, what is the algebra of higher-spin symmetries. For various reasons, I will focus on this because, number one, it's really the probably most fundamental issue that underlies the whole story. But number two, I think it admits a very interesting generalization that may help to understand hidden symmetries of string theory in the end of the day. So that's why I want to focus on that. And then, depending on how much time I have, I will focus on some recent progress in this theory. So to begin with, let me very briefly remind you the story. Well, to many people, the story starts from the paper by Fronsdal of 78, who showed that all massless fields, so in four dimensions, he considered it, they are gauge fields starting from spin 1, and there is some gauge symmetry underlying at the free field level underlying these theories with the gauge symmetry parameters, which are rank S minus 1 symmetric reducible, that is traceless tensors. So there is some symmetry underlying the massless fields, not only for spin 1 and 2, as we know for many years, but also for all higher spins. And that is actually the main issue which makes this study interesting, because it's not that interesting to study, I mean, I don't know how these fields would appear at some experiments, but the most interesting issue is what about these symmetries? Is there some truth behind this, and what might be a non-trivial theory exhibiting these symmetries? Well, actually, even before the Fronsdal work, there were some arguments claiming that in the flat space, such theories exhibiting these higher symmetries are not available. So that's they should be trivial, should be somehow free field theory. And that slowed down the development of this theory for a long time. And also in the 70s, Argon and Deser explicitly analyzed what happens to gravitational interactions for spin 5/2, and they found that, again, it's difficult to introduce these interactions because these interactions would just break gauge symmetries for the case of spin 5/2 in the case they consider it. So there was a conflict between different types of gauge symmetries, the usual types we are familiar with, like diffeomorphisms and Young-Mills, and higher spin symmetries. So that was the problem. Well, on the other hand, in the early 80s, these two groups of Swedish and Dutch group, they found that some higher spin interactions can be introduced, at least in the lowest order. So they found some non-gravitational interactions, but still some interesting interactions, most of which we understand very well now as Noether current interactions for higher spin currents that are familiar here, I guess. So that was an indication that there should be something interesting behind this story. And actually, it turned out that the whole story becomes a lot more interesting if one allows a non-zero cosmological constant in the background. In that case, actually, it is possible, it turns out to be possible to introduce interactions, and the gravitational interaction is a part of the story. But the point is that the limit lambda to zero becomes singular. So there are some interactions that contain higher derivatives and contain inverse powers of the cosmological constant in front of these terms. So indeed, in the flat limit, they blow up and the theory is not well defined. Let me mention some analogy with supergravity in this respect. Actually, this is pretty much analogous to the very well-known fact that in supergravity, if one considers gauged pure supergravity, then cosmological constant should be non-zero if electric charge, for example, for gravitino is non-zero. This is pretty much the same story. If we want higher spin fields to interact, we should switch on cosmological constant. Okay, so after that, actually, it was possible to make some progress, but let me, before going into detail of the formulation, let me just very briefly summarize some general aspects that immediately can be deduced from very general properties of such theories. All right, so we are going to consider a theory that contains, in addition to usual generators of space-time symmetries and inner symmetries, some generators that are higher-rank tensors, because they should correspond to those gauge symmetry parameters that Fronsdal found. Okay, this means that commutation relations should have this form. Lorentz transformations, when commutator with a higher spin generator, will give us a higher spin generator. And actually, similarly for substitutes for translations and anti-de-Sitter, because this T commute to T to Lorentz, this means that these generators also should have non-zero commutation relations with higher spin generators. This is a very simple observation, which, however, immediately tells us that the theory we are going to consider is, in many respects, different from usual theories we are working with, because the same relations can be read other way around. We see from this commutator that if higher spin symmetry is applied to generator of space-time symmetries, and this means if we consider higher spin transformation of the corresponding gauge fields, which is actually graviton, which is spin 2, then we'll get a gauge field, which is a higher spin gauge field. This means that acting by higher spin symmetries to gravitational sector, we get something else. Actually, in supergravity, very similar things happens, but there, parameters are fermionic. Here, the parameters may be bosonic, which is a much more important thing, actually. So the conclusion is the metric tensor itself in such a theory can hardly play a fundamental role. So we should probably find some other means how to describe such a theory, but the metric tensor itself is not an appropriate object, which essentially means that Riemannian geometry is probably not the right framework for higher spin theories. And which means that theory will become somehow non-local in one or another way, and the concept of a local event should be reconsidered, reanalyzed. And essentially, this means that even the concept of space-time dimension should be actually considered as a dynamical object in such a theory. Indeed, this is what happened. I hope to illustrate this a little bit in the rest of my talk. But this is something very serious, indeed. Okay, so we don't want to give up equivalence principle. We want to have a theory formulated in a coordinate independent way, of course. And fortunately, this is possible even if we don't have metric around, because we can use the language of exterior algebra formalism, that Cartan formulation, that allows us to keep independence of coordinates. And here, the important and the fundamental object is the Ram differential that allows us to proceed. Moreover, if we will use this language systematically, as I will try to explain later, that actually helps to understand a lot about the space-time appearance in these theories. It's not just a technical device. It slowly becomes an important, gives us some hints about the holography in particular. Okay, sure. Well, actually, I don't know. I can't answer this question immediately, but... Well, there are... Actually, there is a class of models in here. The simplest model you can... The minimal model, one can introduce just a single field of every even spin. So they carry some indices. In a certain sense, you can view them as a matrix. This is infinite dimensional associative algebra, so in that sense. But it's not precisely probably what. Yes, yeah, that's what I was about to say. But in fact, there are some families of theories carrying matrix indices, indeed. And even spin 2 carries matrix indices. But the point is that there is always a room for a unit matrix in the spin 2 sector. So there is a right place for gravity there, but there are colored spin 2 particles. I would not call them gravitons, actually. This is not gravity. Okay. Okay. So the next comment is that when we analyze what the symmetry is, this is will be explained in a few minutes, we'll see that in a certain sense, this symmetry is a maximal symmetry. In some sense, it cannot be made larger in the setup we are considering. And this, I'm not saying it's not a subalgebra of any larger algebra. That can never be true. But in a certain sense, this is a maximal symmetry, and this property somehow shows up in various corners of the studies. But in some sense, if we really take this seriously, this means that it cannot be obtained through spontaneous breakdown of some larger symmetry. Which is a funny conclusion, because this means that the symmetry should work above any scale, any energy scale, and any means including Planck scale. So it's very likely that we are talking about theory that should work at ultra high energy, infinitely high. And this is where higher spin symmetries have a chance to be explicit. And if this is indeed happens, so this is the way to study quantum gravity, if you like, because we go beyond the Planck scale. Here the main guiding principle is just symmetry. And it turns out that there is no much freedom in considering different types of higher spin symmetries. So the symmetries are very much unique. So this probably gives us a possibility to try to study quantum gravity without actually going into, I don't know, without any experiment and any nothing. We just require it to be sufficiently symmetric. And the only option is, roughly speaking, these higher spin symmetries I'm talking about. So that may well guide us to quantum gravity. This is a kind of toy model, but I believe this argument is basically correct. And in the models I'm going to discuss in the recent developments section of this talk, I will try to mention what should we expect, what kind of generalization that probably may, just a moment, may be rich enough to capture the full string theory and the whole stuff. Yes. Okay, it's not quite the case, I think, because in this model, this is the only dimensionful parameter at hand. So this means that it's just one. It's a choice of coordinates. It's a choice of units. What would be important is to study a model where two massive parameters would appear. One is like lambda, another is like alpha prime, for example, in string theory. Alpha prime is still not here. So in some sense, we go, lambda is just any. It may take any value in that setup. When we will be able to break down higher spin symmetries, then some another parameter of mass scale should appear, and then there will be a non-trivial game between these two, between lambda and this alpha prime. This is what should determine breaking of these symmetries. But somehow we go beyond alpha prime scale, and lambda then it's just a matter of choice of units of length. It's actually very curved. It's very curved space, somehow. Let me mention one issue that I was not going to mention in this talk, but this is actually probably answers your question to some extent. It's a difficult question. But basically, when these theories will be considered and constructed, generally in string theory, for example, there are two issues. There is an issue of low energy expansion. This is what you refer to. And there is a perturbative expansion. This is expansion powers of cosmological constant. In this theory, there is no low energy expansion at all. All derivatives actually appear in the same, they have the same effect. But there is an weak regime, if you like. You can expand in powers of interactions, but you cannot expand in terms of low energies. So it just captures all energies together. And this precisely fits what I said, I think, because the symmetry, they go to beyond any level in energy. Any more questions? Okay. All right. So, well, this is some comment that one should keep in mind when thinking about these theories. This is not usual quantum field theory. That may well go beyond the standard frameworks. On the other hand, these infinite dimensional symmetries, they contain usual symmetries like those that, like supersymmetries of normal type, as finite dimensional subalgebras. So this suggests that there should be a chance to break down higher spin symmetries to the lower spin subalgebras, so that usual theories, field theories we are used to work with, can appear as some low energy parts of this whole stuff somehow. All right. And now let me mention a little bit about ADS-CFT correspondence. And the point is that originally when this peculiar feature of the appearance of relevance of ADS was found out, people were just curious and they didn't take it carefully. But of course, the situation changed a lot after ADS-CFT correspondence came in, and people started to think what one can imagine about possible holography for higher spin theories. So the first papers or saying on this were due to Sandberg and Witten independently, more or less the same time in 2001. But actually more precise conjecture is due to Klebanov and Polyakov in 2002, who conjectured that higher spin theory in ADS-4 should be holographically due to three-dimensional conformal models of vectorial type. So this is kind of sigma models, free or non-free, that describes a number of scalars or spinners carrying a single vector index. It's not a matrix, it's just a vector with respect to the inner indices. So kind of similar conjectures were considered by Sezgin and Sandel, or generalization of this conjecture, but the crucial work and achievement was due to Giambi and Ian from the end of 2009, because in this paper it was shown that it was explicitly checked that the conjecture by Klebanov and Polyakov is going to work. So there were some complete computations that showed that indeed there is correspondence between the correlators of currents in the sigma model and classical solutions in the higher spin theory. Okay, so after that, this work actually triggered a lot of studies and a lot of interest in this field, and many people started to consider this. So I'm just mentioning here some important papers without going into detail. In particular, important paper was by Maldasin and Zhibayedov, who analyzed the story from the point of view of symmetry on the boundary side, and also some others. So I just don't have much time to explain the relation. And also, another conjecture about possible higher spin ADS-3 CFT-2 correspondence was put forward by Gabardil and Gopakumar. And again, there is a lot of work on this issue, and still it's active these days as well. Okay, so there are many arguments why it may be interesting to analyze holography in this higher spin context. One is that this does not require a theory to be supersymmetric. The correspondence can be considered for the bosonic models without any fermions around. So that gives a hint that there maybe is a chance even to understand the origin of ADS-CFT correspondence duality, and indeed I believe this is the case. So actually these models are particularly simple and maybe very helpful to clarify what is the origin of holographic duality in general. Okay, so this here. No, it is not. No. The theorem by Maldacin and Djibeliev is perfectly correct, but the conditions can be voided. And this is precisely what happens to Kolman-Mandelor in some sense. Actually, that work was extremely useful to me. I started to analyze this issue in my own way, and I'm sometimes different from what other people are doing. And the conclusion was quite unexpected. If you, by means I will try to explain, you can actually see explicitly what is a dual model at the boundary. My conclusion is that the dual model, there are two cases in the space of possible boundary conditions, if you can consider, where the statement is precisely correct. So the corresponding higher spin models corresponding to these two cases indeed are holographically dual to free theories, and two because one is dual to bosons and other to fermions. But apart from that, there is infinitely many other cases where the boundary theory is not free. And there are there is important issue, actually. I talked to Djibeliev several times, and somehow we are still talking different languages. But the point is that we do know that the boundary theory is conformal in the sense that there is a conformal symmetry there. This does not mean, however, that the boundary theory is conformal in the standard sense. And let me, once this question appears, let me explain very briefly what can happen and what does happen. What does happen is that we know, for example, in gravity, that in spin 2 case, there is no gauge invariant stress tensor for spin 2 modes. In that sense, I mean, there is, of course, there are Poincaré algebra, but it is not generated by a gauge invariant stress tensor. Here, what happens is precisely the same story. There is a conformal symmetry on the boundary side, but there appear gauge fields for this conformal symmetry. And as a result of that, the corresponding stress tensor is not gauge invariant. And this breaks down one of the assumptions of the theorem, actually, that the boundary theory is a normal conformal theory. It is not what I'm claiming. There is conformal symmetry, but there is the usual principles of conformal field theory are not respected. Stress tensor is not gauge invariant because there are fields that appear which are topological fields like there. There is the in three dimensions, apart from usual matter fields, what contributes there are gauge fields for three-dimensional conformal gravity. Gauge fields. They do not propagate in three dimensions. They do not carry any degrees of freedom, but they do modify the theory. They induce some interactions. In presence of these fields, the stress tensor becomes not gauge invariant. And this is one point where actually the assumption breaks down. This is what I, and actually I asked several times Sasha Djibeliev, and he said that yes, indeed, if it happens, then the theorem is not true. So, I'm not sure. This is my argument. And also one can see that actually the other condition, there are two issues, conformal theory and exactly conserved higher spin current in this theorem by Maldacin and Djibeliev, right? Well, actually, in all those cases, except for the two I mentioned in the beginning, the current does not conserve either, roughly speaking, for the same reason. There are gauge fields. So it's not just usual conservations, it's just covariant conservation, if you like, which means that usual conservation breaks down. Well, this is actually an important issue. I was not going to talk in detail in this talk. It probably requires a separate talk to discuss these issues, but we can discuss after. Otherwise, I will not be able to. Okay? All right. So, just to summarize, when people say that higher spin theory describes free theory at the boundary, I don't agree to this. There are regimes, indeed, where the boundary theory is a free theory, and there are regimes of higher spin theory that capture these particular points. But this is not at all the whole story. Well, this is apart from the ideas that, due to Xi and other people, that actually one should try to consider Chern-Simons models at the boundary as conformal models. What I'm going, it goes beyond even this framework, what I'm saying. Okay. Okay, so let me define what higher spin symmetry is. Historically, the cemetery was found by very different means, from very different arguments. But these days, once we are aware of holography, actually it is much easier to take the point that we can deduce the symmetry from the boundary part. And actually, in that case, the simplest Hirschsprung symmetry is a very simple concept. Namely, consider, this works actually in any dimension, so consider just Maslow's Klein-Gordon equation. This is a linear equation, so it has infinitely many symmetries, of course. The symmetry algebra is infinite dimensional. And actually, I claim that this is the corresponding symmetry is nothing else as the higher spin symmetry, which will become higher spin gauge symmetry in the bulk side. But here is just like that. It will contain conformal symmetry as a part, but it will be an infinite dimensional extension of the conformal symmetry. So the question is, what is this symmetry? It's funny, but such simply formulated equations, it's not very immediate, it's not very easy to answer this question algebraically. And actually, the full construction was first given, I think, in three dimensions in my work with Shankman, and then next year, Eastwood absolutely independently and by different means defined this algebra mathematically. Okay, so let me explain how one can deduce this symmetry in a very simple way. Well, let's consider an auxiliary problem where we would analyze equations that have a form of some covariant constants equation. So let CA be some set of fields carrying index A, capital, whatever it is. D be some covariant derivative where omega is some connection acting on these indices, A. And we require that these covariant derivatives should be flat in the sense that D squares to zero. So this is like flat background or, okay. And the question is, what is the global symmetry of this equation in the case where omega is fixed, some particular connection? Well, the answer is very simple. And the answer is that this global symmetry is just symmetry of general linear transformations acting in the space V, which is labeled by this index A, whatever it is. Indeed, let me show this in a moment. Well, observation number one is that this system is invariant under gauge transformations with x-dependent symmetry parameters that just acts as general linear transformations in the space where C are valued, and connections is transformed just as connection in this GLV group or algebra. So it's quite obvious to see that these equations, this one and this one, are invariant under these transformations. But remember, I mentioned that we want to have omega fixed, which means that we consider something like, for example, flat Minkowski space in Cartesian coordinates or in some particular coordinate system, which means that our connection is fixed. Then we have to restrict these gauge transformations to those that leave this fixed connection unchanged. And this imposes the equation on the global symmetry parameters, which are a little bit reminiscent of those equations that were considered yesterday in the talk on supersymmetries in non-trivial backgrounds. So we actually should analyze how many solutions of these equations exist. And in this case, because D naught is a particular case of D at particular omega, it squares to zero. So all these equations are formally consistent. And this allows us immediately to say that, okay, there are as many solutions of these equations as simply values of the indices taken by omega carried by this epsilon. So we basically can fix epsilon at any given point x, and then the equation will reconstruct for us the dependence on x everywhere. And of course, this consideration is completely local, so if there are some non-trivial boundary conditions, it's not true. So what I'm saying is just is true in the R space, if you like, where there are no topological obstructions. But, and this is a maximal global symmetry of this equation, so basically, for this case, we know the answer. One can write down explicit formula in the pure gauge form. I will skip this part. And the next step is just whether to check whether or not we can represent our Klein-Gordon equation in this form of covariant constants equation. And the answer is yes, we can do this. I'll explain in a moment. Once we have done this, then we can immediately say what the symmetry is. Okay, so how to rewrite Klein-Gordon in this way? Well, actually, the procedure is as follows. Well, first we describe our background by Firbein or Philbein, depending on dimension. And Cartesian coordinate, this means that Lorentz connection is zero and Philbein is just dx. These are Cartesian coordinates. For simplicity, I will use them, but it doesn't matter. Well, the point is that we have to introduce infinitely many fields to rewrite Klein-Gordon equation in this form. And the right set is actually given is consists of all symmetric tensors of all ranks from 0 to infinity, which are all traceless. And what we can do now, we can write down equations which are precisely of the form I mentioned. It's covariant constancy condition, acting on this infinite set of fields. While these equations are consistent formally, if we apply d second time, then because dx is anticommute and because the indices are contracted to a symmetric tensor, this is 0. So the corresponding covariant derivative indeed is flat. And this is the way that, as I claim, how one can formulate Klein-Gordon in this unfolded form, in the form of covariant constants equation. And that to see this is very easy. Let's consider a couple of first equations. So the first equation tells us that CA, reading, just writing this at n equals 0, CA is just first derivative of C, nothing else. There is no dynamics here. It's just a constraint expressing CA in terms of first derivative. The second equation is more interesting. Again, it expresses CAB in terms of first derivative of CB, which means second derivative of C. That's why it is symmetric. But on the top of that, we require these guys to be traceless. And this property immediately implies that C should obey Klein-Gordon equation if this is a traceless field. So the tracelessness of this is how the Klein-Gordon is encoded in the system. Well, then it's almost obvious that all other equations, they just express all these higher tensors in terms of all higher derivatives of the original scalar fields, nothing else. So the conduct is very simple. These are all auxiliary fields. However, contraction of any indices, of course, gives 0 because there will appear a box that will hit C that will give 0. So the conclusion is that this set of fields that we have introduced, it has actually clear meaning. It gives us all space of all on-shell non-trivial derivatives of our fields. What is on-shell trivial just is factored out by this tracelessness condition. So this is the meaning of this space. And as such, this space is actually very much almost the same story as the space of single particle states in the theory, because this is a full space that encodes the whole number of degrees of freedom, if you like. And so that is what always happens in this formulation of this type, which I called unfolded formulation. I hope to have a few minutes to discuss this issue on general grounds. But basically, once one reformulates the theory in this way, then actually a cousin of the space of single particle states appears in this formulation. It is not exactly the space of single particle states because here the norm is not positive. It's not just its complex equivalent, but it's not real equivalent to the space of single particle states because Lorentz indices have pluses and minuses when contracted. So this is slightly different space from single particle states. It's covariant version of the space of single particle states, if you like, but essentially it's very close. It fixes dynamics. If we know all derivatives, then we know a field in some neighborhood of a given point where derivatives are given. Any questions on this? Okay. So now we know the answer. We know what the symmetry is. The symmetry is just the algebra of general linear transformations of the space V, which is infinite dimensional space, that consists of all symmetric traceless tensors. This is the symmetry formally that can be formally defined. This is actually not very good definition because one have to be more careful about, in this infinite dimensional case, about norms, about what which operators are allowed and which are not allowed. Basically, the idea is to keep those generators that generate symmetries containing a finite number of derivatives and finite number of x. So these are local transformations that correspond to this. This is what fixes exactly the algebra. Still, it's not the construction, algebraic construction. It is very well known, but it's a little bit heavy. So I'm now going to explain in much more detail what happens in a very interesting case of D equal 3, where we can use the language of spinners. And this is a kind of twister language that simplifies the story a lot and actually is pretty much related to those most investigated cases of higher spin ADS3, ADS4 safety 3 duality. So this is the case I'm going to very briefly consider. And actually, the point is that in three dimensions, we can describe all invariant or covariant objects as multi-spinners. And the key issue is that anti-symmetrization of a pair of spinner indices, which take two values in three dimension, is proportional to epsilon symbol, which is a Lorentz invariant object in spinner notations. This is a charge conjugation matrix, if you like. So in this sense, all irreducible representations of the Lorentz group given by symmetric traceless tensors, anti-symmetric anti-symmetrization in three dimensions does not give a new object. So they are all represented by totally symmetric multi-spinners of any rank, which is should be even for bosons and odd for fermions. And tracelessness of our tensors is now a consequence of this reformulation in terms of spinner indices. So we just have to consider symmetric spinner tensors to represent symmetric spinner multi-spinners to represent various symmetric traceless tensors. And this is actually kind of very similar to Penrose transform. Okay. I will call these spinners twisters, even though they are not twisters, rigorously speaking, but they play the similar role there. Now, this allows us to pack all the these symmetric traceless tensors into a form of polynomials in Y. These polynomials are symmetric in indices alpha, so for multi-spinners of even ranks, they just give us all traceless symmetric tensors. And in these terms, it's very easy to write massless equation for a scalar field in this form. So this is a spinner version of the unfolded equations that I presented in the tensorial form. So these equations are equivalently rewritten now in terms of spinners acting on the generating function C of Y that contains all these higher rank multi-spinners or equivalent tensors. So I claim that this is the equation for a massless scalar, and actually for a spinner too, if we allow functions that are even in Y, that gives unfolded version of the massless field. But in these terms, it's extremely simple to say what is the algebra, what is the symmetry algebra acting on these fields, because they are unrestricted functions of Y. So basically, we should consider arbitrary operators acting on the functions of these two variables, and this is the answer. So how it can be represented? Well, in the form where the corresponding higher spin transformations are local, is just given by any polynomial of 1 d dy. And this is, if you like, most general operator that leads to a local higher spin symmetry transformations acting on these fields. If we want bosons to be considered, then actually this function should be even. Well, in these terms, we can write down a closed answer for all higher spin symmetries in a very simple form. So this is how it looks like. So we just integrate those equations on epsilon. And the general solution is represented by an arbitrary function of y and d dy. And here is how the x dependence appears. In particular, this formula reproduces the usual conformal, three-dimensional conformal symmetry transformations, which are given by SP4 algebra. And here are the generators of the three-dimensional conformal symmetry that should be plugged in here, epsilon, and then you will get the transformation law of conformal symmetry acting in the, on the free massless fields. Okay. I must say that this formula is very simple, but if one would try to guess the form of these higher spin transformations, it's pretty hard to do if you don't know this, this machinery. But in this way, it's just very trivial, if you like. Okay. So now we can somehow peg this into the more efficient algebraic objects. And namely, we observe that we can unify y and ddy into some spinners carrying now four indices. These four indices later on will become Majorana indices in four dimensions, actually. So we started a three-dimensional model, but by IDS CFT correspondence, this index will become an index of, in the bulk, of the four-dimensional space, spinners, four-dimensional spinners. Now, if we define, if we take this definition, then our y's are not commuting anymore, because ddy does not commute to y, and they form the oscillator algebra. So CAB is some 4 times 4. Well, it's more generally for the while algebra n can be arbitrary, but in our application, this becomes algebra A2. So the rough indices take 4 values. And this is what it's called while algebra, and this is where we can use the machinery, which is very efficient, of the star product language. Replacing heads by stars, we introduce star product that has this canonical form for oscillators. In particular, we can use the Moel star product to realize this infinite dimensional algebra. And actually, what the conclusion is that the higher spin algebra is the star product algebra. This is what we have derived in a few steps. And that is what was known even before the CFT correspondence was known, so we didn't know why this happened, but we knew that the higher spin algebra in ADS4 theory is indeed the star product algebra. Somehow, that's from old days. Okay, so now, being equipped with this, I can explain in a few steps, in a few slides, how the four-dimensional higher spin theory is organized. Let me mention that, actually, during few recent years, I usually avoid to explaining these details because, okay, there are some equations, they are simply looking and difficult to work with, and that's basically all one can say these days. But today I want to make some comment that will start a section of the recent developments. It's some conjecture that maybe is interesting and new, and to make it possible to explain what I'm talking about, I will repeat this construction, actually, to first. So the construction is rather straightforward in the first steps. So we know what higher spin symmetry is. Just introduce gauge fields for the symmetry, which means consider one forms called omega here that depends on the variables y, just as a power series expansion. We can immediately, using star product, introduce the non-abelian higher spin curvature. And the transformation law for higher spin symmetries naively looks like this. This is just covariant derivative. As a first step, it looks like this. So it has a form of usual Young-Mills type covariant derivative and curvature, but applied to this star product acting in this infinite dimensional space of functions of y. So one can actually imagine that this y variables bring in some infinite matrix indices, if you like. You can consider this star product as some infinite dimensional matrix algebra, if you like. So these fields, they are valued in the infinite dimensional matrix algebra, and in this sense, the construction so far is completely Young-Mills. It just introduced Young-Mills curvature and transformation law like this. Okay, so the vacuum, a natural vacuum, there are maybe some others, is given by the gravitational field corresponds to the algebra SP4, because SP4 is anti-de Sitter symmetry algebra. By gauging this algebra, we just arrive at usual Lorentz connection, W and W bar here, and Firmian, H alpha beta dot. So this is how the gravitational fields correspond to gauging of space-time symmetry, if you like. And ADS4 is a geometry which is fixed by the condition that the curvature of this connection is zero, which means that this omega should be flat connection, and also the condition that the field bind is non-degenerate. This is what tells us that this is locally anti-dissipative ADS4. Okay, and this framework allows us very easily to identify a simplest vacuum solution in the Hirschman theory, because SP4 is a subalgebra of Hirschman symmetry. And now we can consider fluctuations. We can expand our fields around this fixed vacuum solution and analyze how fluctuations are organized. And actually, at the linearized level, what happens is that the whole stuff of all massless field equations is very compactly defined and can be formulated as two equations. So here, the system that this R is related to zero forms C, which are just appeared, they introduced in this construction, and some covariant constancy condition for the zero form C, it just gives you the full set of the massless equations for all spins. Okay, I'll explain in some, I'll give examples very soon, but notations are given here. What is important is that there are two types of covariant derivatives here, adjoint and what is called twisted adjoint. So zero forms obey the twisted adjoint covariant constancy conditions, and the linearized higher spin curvature is given by actually joint covariant derivative, which is given by this formula. So there is some difference in the terms associated with the field bind, fear bind. Here it is the first order differential operators in Y, and here it is the second order. All right, so these are definitions, which, I mean, if I would have more time, I'd probably comment more on that. But this is the final result. Never mind on the explicit formula. And the pattern of this equation is as follows. There are fields corresponding to massless fields, and they are described by connections, one forms, such that total power in Y is related to spin, as shown here. So these are polynomials in Y, which are of degree 2s minus 1. The zero forms, they actually are related to a particular spin in such a way that there are infinitely many zero forms related to a particular spin, because not the total degree, but the difference between degrees in Y and Y bar gets fixed in terms of spin. So there are, the point is that the number of Ys should be larger or smaller than the numbers of Y bars, depending on the spin, okay? So here is the collection of fields associated to any given spin. And actually, this is a generalization of the construction that I started with in the example of scalar field. I will show in a moment where it appears here. So basically, this is the full set of fields. And there are frame-like fields where Fronsdahl fields live. These are fields carrying equal number of dotted and undotted indices, and also a scalar, which is C, independent part of Y bar. Now, I'm actually coming to the comment about this absence of low energy expansion here, because as I said, the only dimensionful parameter is lambda here, is inverse radius of anti-de-Sitter. So if one writes this equation and we'll check the pattern, I'll see that most of this equation express higher components in terms of derivatives of the physical fields of this and this, and they contain more and more derivatives because they contain more and more indices. And these derivatives appear in the dimensionless combination like this, lambda to minus 1 times d dx, which essentially means that if there are some higher derivative terms, then lambda will appear in negative powers. And this is actually the reason why higher spin interactions contain are singular in lambda. Okay, this is precisely what happens. So higher spin interactions contain higher derivatives and inverse powers of lambda. Well, in the cases of particular spins, one will see is the following. Spin zero precisely reproduces the example of spin zero that I considered. So in this case, in four dimensions, these objects where the difference between the number of dotted and undotted indices is zero just reproduce symmetric traceless tensors. So this set is precisely the set that we have already seen. And this is precisely the equation for a massless scalar in this setup. For spin 2, for example, we have connections which give us Lorentz connection and Firmin. And also we have zero forms which contain actually Weyl tensor in the Penrose notation of two component spinners. So this is where Weyl tensor appears. And all higher components are just higher derivatives of the Weyl tensor. Again, those which are non-zero on shell. So the space of zero forms give us the full space of non-zero, on-shell, non-trivial components of the Weyl tensor. And again, this is actually something like space of single part. This is the space of single particle states in the spin 2 case. Okay, so equations tell us that torsion is zero. This is one of the equations contained in the central on-shell theorem. And the other tell us that Riemann tensor equals essentially to the Weyl tensor, which is nothing else as saying that Ricci is zero. And this is how the Einstein equation appears in this system. And similarly, it appears for all higher spin fields. So Fronsdahl equations is a kind of derivation of this condition that Ricci is zero. That's roughly speaking how it works. Then one should consider some nonlinear, full nonlinear theory. To do it, one should covariantize derivatives. One should replace linearized derivatives by the full ones. But this is not the end of the story because of this term. So some more terms should be added. And actually, proceeding directly is a very hard problem. But there is some trick that allows one to formulate the full theory in a compact way. And that requires some additional spinner variables. Without going into details, basically one introduces some specific star product that involves a doubled number of spinner variables. And one introduces the set of fields which contains connection in X space, connection in Z space in these new variables, and zero form B, which is a substitute for those zero form C. So we have some connections now in the twister space, in the space of Z variables. And there is an important ingredient that actually will play a crucial role for what I'm going to discuss. In addition, one has to introduce what is called Klein operators. Klein operators are those that anti-commute to either undotted spinners or dotted spinners. However, there are two types. There is inner Klein operator kappa here that is generated by some star product elements. So it acts on the functions of z, y, and z bar, y bar, just changing a sign of this z and y when commuting. But this is not enough, and one should introduce some other Klein operators that also act on differentials. And these are other objects that have to be introduced because differentials, there is no other way to change a sign. And this somehow is important. So in these terms, the full story can be compactly formulated in the form of these only two equations. So this is a nonlinear version of higher spin equations that reproduces linearized equations. So this is the compact form where dx and dz connections are all put into this W calligraphic. And when rewritten in terms of different components, this is dx dx part, this is dx dz part, this is dz dz part. So this is how this equation looks like. I don't probably have time to explain more detail this system because I want to specify some very particular issue here. Yes? Thanks. The point is that if you have any solution of these equations, then you can linearize around this solution. It's pretty much the same way. Under de Sitter is kind of trivial solution for these equations. You can immediately identify it just because the under de Sitter is solved this equation by construction, then B is zero, S actually is defined to commute to this Y variable, so it's a trivial solution of this equation. So to linearize around tangent de sitter is very simple. But given any other solution, you can try to linearize. And actually, this is what I'm going to discuss right now, in particular. Yeah. Yeah, for tangent de sitter is just the basically these terms go away. So this means that you can set S be equal to DZZ that solve this equation. And this this equation tells us that W is Z independent. Then you just take tangent de sitter solution and that solves this one. So that's end of story, B is zero. But in all other solutions, especially in those where B is non-zero, and this is the case for black holes in particular, it's much more complicated to find and to analyze what happens. But there are some solutions that we, to some extent, know, I would say, let me put it like that. All right, so this system is gauge invariant. It's rather manifest, so this solves the issue. But now I would like to discuss some, precisely as Joe was asking, that what kind of other vacuum solution we can consider. And I want to suggest some, to make some suggestions that probably extends the framework for ADS safety respondents. Now let me make the following comment. Our fields, they were functions of this Klein operator, K. K is a pair of Klein operator, K and K bar. So because K squares to one, this means that there are four types of fields, 2 by 2. Okay, so the original massless fields are related to this expansion components expanding expansion in terms of K and K bar. But there are only two, indeed, massless fields. These are fields where indices I and J in omega are the same, and where the indices are different for C. However, the full system contains more. It contains a sector of fields that were called in old days auxiliary fields. And actually, the reason why they were called auxiliary fields is again related somehow to the yesterday's talk, because the simplest system of this is the auxiliary fields of the new minimal supergravity. Actually, this is just the part of the story I'm going to discuss. So somehow these fields naturally appear in this framework. And I must say that originally these sectors were introduced just to simplify the setup, because it's simpler to write it. And I didn't pay much attention to what is the role of these fields. And now I would like to say that actually these fields play a very significant probably role in the model. Well, so the fields that were called auxiliary fields in old days, now I would prefer to call moduli fields, they each of the system describes at most a finite number of degrees of freedom. A finite number of degrees. It's not a field theory. It's just one or I don't know, depending on the Lorentz tensor. So in some sense, it's probably most natural to identify these fields with the coupling constants in the theory. You can play with the values of these fields, should solve some equations, and then we'll give you finite dimensional spaces for some module of the theory. And in most cases so far, all these fields were completely truncated away, simply because there is indeed a symmetry that allows one to do this, to allow one to truncate away these fields, if they are setting all of them to zero. And what I would like to emphasize, and this is very old stuff that is going to become recent soon, I think, again, because I believe that this somehow allows to consider much wider framework and very interesting examples of models that were not considered so far. All right, so this whole story about the structure of higher spin equations, in this talk, the aim was just to emphasize that there is a room for the fields that usually are not considered in the analysis. And actually, it's by the methods of this unfolded machinery, one can easily see that they indeed describe a finite number of degrees of freedom each. And this follows from the structure of twisted adjoint and adjoint representations, which actually have been exchanged compared to the massless field. So in this case, the curvature has a form of twisted covariant derivative, and this equation has a form of adjoint. And that's from where immediately follows those conclusions that I mentioned. So the simplest examples of the systems described by these equations are given by BF like systems. So we consider a Lagrangian that is 2-form times d 1-form in 4 dimensions, or 3-form times d 0-form. These are obviously systems that describe a finite number of degrees of freedom. Or, okay? And these actually are particular cases of the systems represented here, but let me mention that actually in this setup, there is infinitely many generalizations of these simplest cases, which are also hidden here somehow. And that's why I think this is a very interesting story, which probably may go far enough. Yes? Well, space-time is four-dimensional space-time in this setup. So it's only represented by the Dirac differential that enters this covariant derivative, actually. I'll come back to the issue of space-time. I hope to have a few minutes to.
Started out as writing the space-time.
Well, as a matrix, it's x alpha beta dot. This is the coordinates of space-time derivative. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's in this setup, it's still there. Yeah, it's four-dimensional setup, and this means that x is x alpha beta dot in this language. Yes, right. But actually, you notice some very important issues, that space-time slowly goes away. And it indeed goes away. We will see that actually the whole physics is described by twister space. And what we choose as space-time is, to a large extent, is up to us. I'll come back to this point. And that will explain holography, maybe, hopefully. Okay. So, as I said, there is some symmetry that allows one to truncate away these fields. And this is the normal setup. And this is most symmetric setup, if you like. But one can do something different. And actually, an example of this have been already considered in the context of higher spin theory in ADS 3. And it was observed there by Prakushtin and myself long ago that if one let one of these fields be a constant rather than just zero constant, then this the parameter nu appears, and this gives a mass to matter fields in this system. And actually, this parameter plays a very important role in the modern studies of ADS 3 CFT2, because this is precisely the lambda parameter that appears in those models. Now, the new conjecture that I would like to put forward here is that actually one can do something similar in the four-dimensional theory, letting actually the same field, the scalar component, in this modular sector to be a constant. And I conjecture that this corresponding theory should actually correspond to holographically dual of massive boundary fields. And as such, this theory is not conformal anymore. It is not conformal in the symmetry in the bulk gets reduced. That ADS symmetry is not around if this nu is a constant. So it reduces to Lorentz symmetry. Actually, observation was made long ago, soon after this paper. But the interpretation in the context of ADS CFT was not available. And I think this is something new. It's work in progress, but I'm pretty much sure that it should be the correct conjecture, and actually if one will be able to develop the machinery for this case of nu equal constant. By the way, one of the issues is just what Joe was asking, is how to explicitly construct a vacuum solution corresponding. It's not that trivial anymore. One should actually elaborate this solution. Once it is elaborated, it will be possible to construct fluctuations and to make precise compare. So this is what working. Not only for free. And again, it's very much like in the massless case, there will be different regimes. What is interesting and is a little bit mysterious is what are substitute for conformal higher spin gauge fields in this massive case. So there will be some gauge fields gauging some symmetry algebra, but it will be different from the higher spin algebra I have defined so far. It can be, on the other hand, clearly defined. It's simply more complicated. And the ribosome gauge fields of Chern-Simons type related to this algebra that will mediate interactions between matter fields at the boundary. But this is all I can say now. I just don't know any details actually on that. Very good. Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, this is probably a model of how one should expect alpha prime to appear. Now there are two parameters, both massive. So this mu gives a mass, real mass of our fields. Lambda is still there, but now one can try to play with limits, sending maybe lambda to zero and sending this mu to zero. So this gives us somehow the two parametric family of models, which indeed are very suggestive in that respect in the string theory context, I believe. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, as I said, I didn't do much so far. I mean, I'm working in this, and I'm pretty much convinced that it is going to work. But technical details become a lot more complicated than in the massless case, as you probably know. So, okay, we'll see. Okay. No, I mean, in this case, I also believe that there should be some room for a Hirschsprung theory dual to free massive field theory. I don't know, but I would not be surprised if it worked like this. Oh, yes. Now, there are two issues. Yeah, there is some ambiguity or freedom in boundary conditions, if you like, that you can play with. It's I prefer a slightly different language, but essentially this is equivalent, I think. Okay. Well, I didn't mention much, even though I showed some formula. There is a class of Hirschsprung theory because there is a freedom in one function in the interactions. So this gives a parameter. So you can play with this parameter. For particular cases of this parameter, you can consider specific truncations, so that the truncations in terms of fields, so truncating away half of fields, it will give you a consistent theory which will exactly dual to free theory at the boundary. But if you don't do this, take parameter different or take boundary conditions, because truncation is actually equivalent to taking particular boundary conditions. No, this module is different deformation. It's a vacuum expectation of a particular field, which is a moduli field.
Is there a correspondence between the number of these moduli fields and say the number of relevant operators that you perform the theory with?
Well, no, I'm not sure. I think it's a different issue. Well, conformal group, by the way, is completely broken immediately. Yeah, you can consider, of course, yes, you can consider relevant deformation, but yeah. I don't know. let me just say I don't know. Well, I'm actually in a difficult position because I'm running out of time. So that's all right. So, okay. Well, there was some issue I wanted to discuss, this unfolded machinery general features. Let me very briefly mention that. Once this is indeed reformulated this is the form what I call unfolded form, where exterior differential of every differential form is a function of the same set of forms. So we have seen examples, so one can always do that. That of course keeps invariance under diffeomorphisms. and allow us to analyze many issues, but most important part is probably the space-time dependence. Indeed, in this formulation, actually, it doesn't matter much how many coordinates are included in the exterior differential, in the Durham differential here. And what one can do, one can, for example, play with adding more coordinates and keeping the same system equations, but extending or reducing the space of coordinates by simply adding additional directions. So here, dz refers to the Poincaré coordinates in the context of ADS-CFT in a standard way. So what we can try to do, we can consider equations which have the same form, which means this function g is the same, but have different number of coordinates. Well, this system, what we can say about this change? What we can say is there are two things. Number one is that formal consistency of this system is insensitive to how many coordinates we actually consider. Well, and number two is that adding or removing coordinates leave dynamical content of the system the same. This can be seen as follows. Suppose we started with some x small coordinates, and we had some system of this with dx small here. Suppose we know what is described by this system. But we know that the full set of data, if we have a system like this, is encoded in the values of our fields at a given point, x naught. And actually, a given point in a smaller space on in a larger space is the same set of data. So it does matter whether we say that we consider this x naught in a smaller case or x naught, z naught in a larger space. This is the same set of data because the index omega takes the same number of values. Moreover, extension of this system to additional variable z will just reconstruct the dependence on these fields omega in terms of z variables and does not affect the original field equation. So roughly speaking, what happens is that there is a kind of generalized Penrose transform where there is a spinner twister space T. Unfolded equations resolve, so solving unfolded equations reconstructs the dependence on x. And this is actually a generalized Penrose transform in a very general terms. And then one can find solutions of our equations by projecting to appropriate components. Okay, so that actually suggests that holography can be classified by classifying these functions G. We can consider systems in different spacetimes, and if they are described by unfolded equations with the same functions G, then they have a good chance to be holographically dual. Okay, I probably should skip. Well, there was this issue. I have discussed most of the issues. Let me just mention that, of course, one of the problems is to find the relation between higher spin theories and string theory. And, well, they are so far very different because higher spin theories contain a lot, not enough degrees of freedom. They, roughly speaking, correspond to the first regular trajectory in the string theory. So it would be very interesting to find a larger symmetry that would contain as many states as full string theory. And the key issue how to do this, so there were some conjectures, and actually that there are some larger symmetries was analyzed by David Gross long ago. But there were some conjectures, well, very interesting, but not quite complete conjecture was given by Enquist and Sundel, I think. And more recently, it was conjectured that by Chang, Minwala, Sharma, and Yin that string theory is in some senses quantum higher spin theory. And that I fully agree, and actually I want to make a little bit more specific this conjecture. It's going to be true, I think. The treatments are different, but the conclusion is basically the same. All right, how much time do I have? Well, I think I can, what I can would prefer to do now, I would prefer to have having 10 minutes, up to 10 minutes, I would finish with these ideas, or maybe even.
Why don't we thank you and let people go? It's a pretty technical subject for people who aren't involved.
Yeah.
So let's
thank you for their. Okay. So the conjecture is that, remember we started with the analysis with what is higher spin symmetry. So here, what I would like to conjecture is what is a substitute for the string full string theory. And the conjecture is that this is the current operator algebra in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So very briefly, I will just summarize the main ideas because the full story is not quite short. All right, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to briefly explain what is this algebra. So this is an algebra of currents constructed from massless fields in 2 plus 1 dimensions. In the unfolded machinery, these massless fields can be described in the form of equations that I have already shown. But here, let me just mention that actually, there is an ambiguity in this sign here, plus minus I, which does matter if we consider normalizable solutions. And this is precisely what distinguishes between creation and dilation. It's positive and negative frequencies, particles and antiparticles in this language. And this is one of the very surprising outputs of this analysis, is that this seemingly classical consideration upon this, applying this machinery, it somehow induces quantization because it allows us to distinguish between positive and negative frequencies and allows us to quantize. So this happens because the operator ddy ddy is positive, is negative definite, is actually. And so one can, putting different signs here for normalizable functions makes difference. One can explicitly see how two branches appear by solving this linear system by standard Fourier transform. So there are positive and negative frequencies, as I said. One can introduce full field that contains both of them, as in usual in field theory. And in these terms, one can consider and construct conserved currents as bilinears of these fields. So here, the parameter n is introduced that is a color index. So how many colors are there? This is n capital. One can see that, indeed, this equation is conformal invariant. And one can check that primaries give the full list of primaries for conserved currents in 2 plus 1 dimensions with correct dead dimensions. And so that is the unfolded form for conserved currents in 2 plus 1 dimension. So the current conservation conditions take this form. This dx alpha beta means stripping out two u parameters implies that divergence of this current is zero. A little comment about this CFT3-ADS4 is actually what one can do immediately. One can add Poincaré coordinates. It's a little bit oversimplified presentation here, but the idea is correct. So one can add, roughly speaking, Poincaré coordinate to see that these conservation conditions are mapped to the equations for massless fields precisely in the form that we have consider it in this central Lanczhoff theorem. Now I'm going to quantize. So quantization is very straightforward. We just postulate commutation relations. And actually, it turns out that in terms of spinor variables, the commutation relations get extremely simple. We can now define them for equal x's, given that y's are different. And it turns out that usual prescription for quantization give us just delta functions here. Okay, and one can deduce from this formula the standard commutation relations for free fields. And d functions are evolution operators that allow to propagate field, if you like. So this is what allows you to describe evolution. And here, the evolution is described in terms of twister variables rather than in terms of x variables. That is very important. So one can do whole stuff entirely in the twister space. Moreover, one can actually extend the full story to the bulk d function, and then this is what I would call twister to bulk d function that allows us to map the twister space to the bulk or boundary depending on what we want. Now I introduce quantum currents, which are bilinears of this phi as operators now. And we, it is convenient to contract, instead of keeping all arguments free, it's convenient to integrate with a kind of test function g here to hide all this freedom in these two variables here. So we have bilinear currents that is a function of g. Okay. All right, so this gives us a possibility to describe all bilinear currents. Moreover, x dependence can be completely hidden or moved to the dependence on g. So by using the evolution formula with d function, this can be completely packed in the dependence on g. So in that sense, the x dependence is not a crucial issue. As I was trying to emphasize several times, the whole story occurs in the twister space. The x dependence can be reconstructed in the very end. Now, an elementary standard computation allows one to compute operator product. It contains regular term that usually is not written. It contains a term that contains two contractions and a central-like term with, one contraction, and here is two contractions. Okay, so the formula involves just convolution product, which is related to star product by half Fourier transform. And by the way, this just makes the ADS-CFT correspondence story very, very precise, because this is how the star product appears very naturally from the boundary side. Okay, so what is the full set of operator in this current operator algebra? It's actually given by all normal ordered products of the original currents. And because this product is symmetric under the sign of normal product, one can actually take the same function g. It's symmetric functional. And this gives us the full set of operators in this operator algebra. The question what it is, whether we can see what it is. The answer is yes. It's very simple to say it in words, because it is easy to derive from this formula that the commutator of these two currents is nothing else as the current of the commutator, because this term cancels and this term cancels. This is the only one that survives. Given this setup, we actually know that there is the only one algebra exists that has this property. This is universal enveloping algebra of the Hirschsprung algebra of the star product. So we actually immediately said, okay, this operator algebra for free currents is the universal enveloping algebra, or Lie algebra associated with the universal enveloping algebra of this Hirschsprung algebra. And this is the full answer. Well, okay, so this makes it possible to proceed. The last technical comment, and I'm about to finish, is that in this case, the fact that Hirschsprung algebra was maximal plays, again, a crucial role, because it allows to construct explicit formula for the product law in this universal enveloping algebra, which is usually difficult to do for other Lie algebras. And that allows us to construct explicit formula for correlators and for operator algebra in a very explicit form that I have no time to mention in this talk. Let me just summarize. Yes, maybe one comment I should make, actually, that is very important, is the following, is that what I said is that the algebra is universal enveloping, and one puzzling point is that there was a parameter n capital here, and in my definition, there is no room for this parameter. It turns out that theories with different n are described by the same algebra, and this is very confusing result, because we have different field theories with different number of fields, and operator algebra, our claim is the same. This isn't it true. However, correlators are different because it turns out that there is some freedom in writing down correlators and traces, and this is probably the freedom in choosing actions on the boundary side. Okay, so this is the proposal that this multiparticle algebra is probably going to be a symmetry of a string-like extension of the Hirschsprung theory. There are many indications that is going to be true, and this fits the conjecture of these authors, because the symmetry actually is the symmetry of what? It doesn't act on the single particle states. It relates all multi-particle states in the higher spin theory. And this is, roughly speaking, what is going to be the full space of string theory. Okay, so I think I should finish. So there are many aspects that I have mentioned in my talk, so this is the least. And let me stop here, because I'm sorry for being a little bit too late. With? Yeah.
Well, there seem to be at least two ways that you could discuss it correctly. One is the way you did in the modularized sector.
Yeah.
The other is to move the constant into the physical sector and expand the theory on this. Right. Well, it's different things, so I wonder if there's any relation.
Well, I don't think that anyone is elaborated, so we should elaborate both and then see. This one is attractive in many respects. It seems to be a right thing to do. Yes. Well, okay. Okay, as long as there are free theories, yeah, but there is a room for free massive theories as well. But if it's not free, then these higher spin symmetries get gauged. This is what I was mentioning. The symmetries there become gauged, and there are gauge fields in the setup that are responsible for these symmetries. In particular, there are gauge fields for conformal symmetry. Yes, this is a kind of that, yes, but not usual Chern-Simons with respect to inner symmetries. It's Chern-Simons with respect to higher spin symmetries. Right. This is what I expect to be there. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I know. Yeah, but I just. Well, the comment is that I'm not sure. It's probably a different story. Maybe it's different. These are different theories. But this looks very attractive in many respects. So this is basically not like. Well, if you restrict yourself to the sector of physical fields, then this is a different theory what I'm talking about. This is not just in that sector. It's not a particular solution in the usual theory as actually the standard proposal would be about. But I'm saying that I'm considering different theory where a natural ADS CFT should be of that type. Well, I don't see any conceptual problem with that, but I don't quite understand what you are saying, because the B field is a constant. It's more or less gauge invariant statement. I mean, if you have a twisted, yeah. No, but this field is in a joint. It's not in a twisted joint. What I'm talking about, and that's why you cannot affect it. Okay, we can discuss it now. Yeah.
If there's no more, thank you for your time.